This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver
Commercial
Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to the Vancouver Commercial Real Estate Podcast. I'm Corey Wright. And on the program today, we are joined by Brad Jones, Chief Development Officer from West Group. And for those who don't know, Brad's been on the program before. And before we talked a little bit about DCCs and ACCs and some of all these additional costs that developers have to go through and coming out of 2025, into 2026, where the development world definitely has been on the slower side. We've seen development land sales very slow. We've seen condo absorption of new product very slow. So we wanted to bring Brad back on the program today to kind of unpack a little bit of what goes on behind the scenes in the development world and what are all of the rules and costs that developers have to consider when building a project. And I think, unfortunately, developers kind of get painted with a bad brush with regards to, you mean, the type of money and they can make on projects and all of that stuff. But I really don't think the general public understands the risk factor that goes into involved with these projects and all of the costs upfront that these developers take on. So Brad's here today to kind of paint a little bit more of a picture of what they go through and why developers just can't build whenever they want. REDMA and all of those things that go into it. So another great episode. Today on today's program, we've got Brad Jones, Chief Development Officer with West Group. Enjoy, guys.
This podcast is presented by Impact Commercial.
Impact Commercial. John, Alan, the team over there are fantastic. They've all been on the show.
They have, yeah.
Friends of the show.
Great guys.
Wealth of experience. They can help with all your commercial financing needs.
Whether it's owner-occupiers, land development funds, commercial investments, or multifamily, these guys got you covered.
And they recently obtained their CMHC correspondent lender status.
So for all your commercial lending needs, visit them at impactcommercial.ca.
That's impactcommercial.ca.
Attention realtors, homebuyers, and investors. If you missed out on Atlin at Clayton Crest by Zentera Developments, here's your second chance.
Atlin sold 80% in just 3 months, Adam. And because of that success, Zentera is launching Building 2, Butte.
Located in West Clayton and walking distance to the future SkyTrain station, prices are still low for now, but not for long.
Homeowners across the Lower Mainland are using equity from their current homes to invest in West Clayton, ahead of the SkyTrain and the next market upswing, because when that SkyTrain is complete and the market rebounds, it'll be too late.
This, Matt, is how wealth is built. Find out why Atlin sold so fast and register now at buttecondos.ca. That's B-U-T-E condos.ca.
All right, so we're here today with Brad Jones, Chief Development Officer from West Group. Brad, how are you doing today?
I'm good, Corey. Thanks for having me again.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. We've had you on the program before where we were talking about some of the challenges that come with the developing world there. And we wanted to sort of dive back into that with you because obviously the economy is challenging, the developing world's challenging. But before we get into that, can you let us know a little bit more about yourself and West Group?
Yeah. So I've been at West Group, actually, I think 11 years now, and we're one of the largest privately held real estate organizations, we say in Western Canada, but it applies to Canada as well. So we're active across the Lower Mainland in every asset class and predominantly try to focus in large mixed-use master plan communities like River District, Inlet District, and Brewery District that you see across the region. And then, yeah, my background actually came into real estate development through urban planning, but yeah, I've been in on the development side for over 15 years now.
I think it's fair to say West Group definitely is one of the larger developers and leaders in the space there with the master plan communities and the years and years and years you guys have done this.
One question we get quite often on the program is from the general public is, why can't developers just build? Why don't they just start building if we have a housing crisis? And I don't think a lot of people understand the costs that go into this. I don't think a lot of people understand, you mean, the challenges around REDMA and what REDMA is. Can we maybe start, and I know I just gave you a long runway there, can we maybe just start with the economics and just where is the developing world at right now, and why aren't developers just throwing shovels in the ground every time they need to?
Yeah, so, you know, real estate development, building anything is really capital intensive. It costs a lot of money. So, you know, large projects that you see around, these are hundreds of millions of dollars. And so to get those types of projects moving, you need to attract capital, and it needs to be an attractive investment. Even for an organization like us that's self-capitalized, you know, you're weighing all of the options that you have. So if moving forward with a development project, which is really risky, and somebody in the industry I know in Toronto calls it biblical level risk, which is true, you're putting on larger projects hundreds of millions of dollars at risk to execute and you know, build it, get it into the market, get it approved before you do any of that. So it needs to have a return that's commensurate with that exceptional amount of risk and time, because a lot of these projects take, you know, 6 to 10 years or longer. So, you know, you're weighing that against hopefully not a savings account or a GIC, but bonds, stock market, just owning and operating a building. So, you know, the market that we're in now, in almost every asset class, you know, rentals still held up, but that's predominantly because of CMHC financing. But as rents fall and costs, you know, are relatively stable, they're falling off, the profitability of these projects isn't actually hitting investment criteria. Then on the condo side, to do any sales right now at the value that the market's at, you're actually losing money unit by unit that you sell. So we basically are calling it a no-bid market across a lot of the region, because, you know, there's investors out there, people that, you know, maybe will buy something because it's a really good deal, but you're actually selling it because you need to, not because you're making a return. So, you know, we could build projects today or try to, but you'd either be putting up all the cash yourself and hoping to break even is the goal for a lot of organizations right now, or losing money. But the reality is you're not going to get investors to come into the project to advance it. And you're also not going to hit a return that's required by a bank to finance it, because the banks aren't going to finance a project that they see as unviable and will likely lead into a failure.
Now, can we unpack that a little bit? Because I think if we look at it from the outside, not understanding all of these costs that go into it, if a developer selling a condo at $1,000 a foot or $1,200 a foot, how are they not making money? From the general public, it seems absurd, but from behind the scenes, there's a ton of costs and risks that go into that. Can we maybe unpack a little bit the type of costs that developers have to deal with from municipal and all of that stuff and upwards?
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of cost categories. So obviously you need to buy land, and land has a value. And it's an interesting point in the land market right now, because this is where I think land economics has failed on the policy side, is that land values are predominantly based right now off of what's the existing use on the site, because redevelopment isn't viable. And so if we didn't have existing uses, land would be falling more than it is. But the baseline value of land is what it's used for today. So a large redevelopment project actually can't outcompete the value of a single family home right now. And it can't outcompete the income that comes off of an old retail strip mall. So land has a baseline value, and projects are struggling to pay, frankly, anything for land. A lot of projects that you look at the potential of, the residual land value of that is zero when you take out all of the other costs. So land is a huge component. Construction costs is obviously, you know, a significant component. A lot of our construction costs are driven by code. Our building code escalates every few years, with sustainability requirements predominantly driving a lot of costs. And so, you know, you look at projects around the region, you know, they're comfortably large high-rise projects are, you know, over $450 a square foot construction costs, if not over $500 a square foot. And so, you know, when we're selling, you know, if you say you're selling for $1,000 or $1,200 a foot and you're barely making money, well, you've got to buy the land, you've got hard costs that are $500 a square foot. You need to have an entire team that works on the project. And you need to pay a lot of fees to local government, which we'll get into. You need to take out debt and pay off that debt, which requires interest payments. And so, you know, there's a lot of carry on these types of projects. The government fees and charges piece has gotten so much attention in the last few years. I was at the Metro Vancouver board meeting on Friday and spoke to the board about the Metro DCC increases, because since 2019, those are scheduled to increase by 1,942%. Outside just about anything you can find in the economy beyond, you know, NVIDIA and Bitcoin. And, you know, I made the example to them that if we applied that type of growth factor to eggs, there's so much talk in this country about grocery inflation. And, you know, there's not enough competition in the grocery stores and government needs to regulate grocery stores. Well, if we applied Metro Vancouver's cost increases on development charges to eggs, a dozen eggs would be $62. An iPhone would be $19,000. You know, if they made cars, a base Honda Civic would be $349,000. So we're in a place that's just completely lost its sense. And I think the last time we talked, actually, I said, I think the growth pressures from immigration have really broken the funding tools that are available in the country to respond to the crisis. And that's really where we're still at in my mind, is that, you know, we have had a federal immigration target that was significant growth. That's been held back now. But the tools that municipalities and local governments have to fund infrastructure haven't been updated since, you know, municipalities were given power in British Columbia in, I think, the 1870s. They're fundamentally the same tools. So we're struggling with this issue. But what's happening is those costs are becoming a bigger and bigger component of project costs. And so as the market's gone off, those costs have actually gone up. And so we see, you know, a city like Vancouver responds and they're lowering their fees and charges in an effort to try to get projects off the sidelines. City of Coquitlam has started to do that. City of Surrey did a rollback, and then Metro Vancouver goes ahead with increases that eat away all the savings that the other governments are trying to create. That's a very, very long-winded answer to your question of, you know, basically the costs of delivering a project are higher than the revenue for selling one right now.
Unreal. Well, I think a lot of people in the general public don't understand all of those crazy costs that come into it on the back end. And on top of that, you mentioned earlier about investors and bank financing and stuff like that. And some groups like yourselves are probably in a position to self-finance these projects, but a lot of developers probably aren't, where they have to have money raised typically through a limited partnership, general partnership structure. They have to achieve bank financing and banks have to see a certain rate of return on the funds out in order to qualify that. One thing to go even one step further that maybe we can provide some light on is REDMA, which is the Real Estate Developing and Marketing Act. And it was an act that was introduced to kind of, I'm going to go as far as to say, protect the end consumer with regards to developers having to make a disclosure statement prior to putting things on sale, filing that with the superintendent of real estate, strata plans, and then they had to secure financing within a certain time period to protect the public. Can you add a little bit of context to what REDMA is and just how much that really affects the developing world?
Yeah, that's well described. And it really is. It's a piece of consumer protection legislation to regulate the industry selling pre-sales. And so before we can start sales, we need to have our permits in place, you know, like rezoning in place, development permit in place. It's defined there. And then we have a certain period of time to sell and achieve our financing requirements, as well as to get a building permit from the city. So it basically makes sure your project is in a place where it can go ahead. And at that, if you get to the end and, you know, you've spent 3 or 4 years designing a project, getting your permits, you spent millions of dollars doing that. You spent, you know, millions of dollars in a sales and marketing campaign to attract those buyers. If you get to the end of your REDMA timeline and you haven't achieved enough sales to get financing and you don't have your building permit, all of your purchasers can walk away. And so it creates, you know, a significant risk profile on the developer to get all of that in place. And so, you know, typically what we're seeing is the banks require the project to be pre-sold to a certain extent. They want the market to have, you know, de-risked the project so that we don't have, you know, make a number up, $200-500 million of inventory at the end of a project that you have to sell because the carrying cost of that is huge. So it does, you know, the REDMA forever was the recent future. It was a 12-month period to do that. And as projects got bigger and bigger and density went up, it was getting, you know, nearly impossible to do the number of sales you needed to hit your pre-sale target of the bank within that 12 months. So after, you know, a lot of work by the industry working with BCFSA, which implements REDMA, there's an exemption now or an extension that you can get to push that to 18 months, which is helpful for big projects. And kind of just as we got that, the market completely turned around. But REDMA is unique in Canada. I don't believe there's a province that has that type of consumer protection legislation and that type of a timeline on pre-sales. If you talk to groups that operate in Toronto predominantly, this is a completely unheard of concept to them.
So now, do you think from a developer standpoint that REDMA is something that they need to sort of maybe relook at? Because I would think, and you know, Ian, I'm not the developer, but if I have to achieve a certain threshold of sales, and let's say my lender puts me at 50% or 60% pre-sales in order for my construction financing to kick in, if I don't feel the market is there or I can't build these things for the price I need to build them to get those type of revenues, I potentially may not even build. Do you think from REDMA's standpoint that something potentially could be relooked at, maybe lengthened out? Because if I'm, you know, the public may not realize how many hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars that go into pre-con and go into your showrooms and all of that. That's a pretty big risk if you can't secure financing.
Yeah, it's a really blunt tool at the end of the day. So you nailed it. And there's multi-millions of dollars and many years that lead up to these projects launching for sales. And if you get to the end of the road and you haven't hit that target, you know, you've basically kind of lost that effort. So I can't say right now that changing REDMA would really change anything because, you know, I could have 100 months to try to pre-sell a project. It just isn't going to happen today at rates that make sense, that make a project profitable to take to a bank. But I think, you know, I think overall we need policies that are a lot more responsive to market conditions. And it's how the policies interact together. So, you know, I'll use an example of inclusionary zoning requirements. A lot of municipalities have those. So, the projects are getting bigger. So say you used to have a 25-story tower. That's now a 40-story tower because the city wants you to pay for a bunch of community amenities as well as to fund below market housing in the community. Well, that I still have to pre-sell 70% of the value of that project. And so my pre-sales for the market units need to cover all of the other costs. So even if there's non-market units, my pre-sales need to cover that delivery cost. And so these projects have gotten bigger to accommodate more things. And, you know, that makes these projects bigger, riskier, they take longer. And we did not have a policy response from REDMA's perspective for quite some time to that issue. And I think partly, you know, the industry, you know, we were probably late in reacting to it as well, because for a while the pre-sale market worked quite well. So that, you know, it wasn't an emergency. And I think once data and information was provided, it was a pretty productive conversation with the team at BCFSA. But I think, you know, there's a lot of what we're dealing with right now is policy being unresponsive to market conditions. It was set when the market was really, really strong. And we've had a really long runway for the most part in the Lower Mainland with, you know, a couple of year pockets here and there of, you know, real estate appreciating and projects pre-selling. And everything worked. So it was just a layering on of requirements. And it's really hard to take all of those things away.
Now, is there any one thing that from a developer standpoint that could be relooked at or could maybe help get development off the ground right now in the challenging market that it is?
Is there one thing?
Is there one thing? Or maybe, you know, let me rephrase that. Is there, what would you do or what things would West Group do if we could say, hey, we want to move the needle? How do we move the needle? we would make the following suggestion that would help get shovels in the ground.
Yeah. So I think the reality of it is it's a suite of issues, and it's, you know, it's probably close to 10 things. So, and I think it's each level of government. So let's start federally. The federal government has actually pretty limited tools to play with in the housing market before they start really dipping into provincial territory. So the number one thing the federal government can do is they could remove the GST on purchases of new housing. You know, that policy, I think, was implemented in 1991. The thresholds of which GST is triggered hasn't changed since then. Home prices sure have since 1991. So it's really, you know, it's a really excessive tax on new housing. It's a major revenue stream for the federal government. The, you know, Carney campaigned on a first-time homebuyer removal of GST. That has been in a draft form of legislation for nearly a year. It hasn't made its way. I think it's with the Senate now, so it's in the process. But it's disappointing that it's taken that long. But I think across the board, you know, we need to see that major tax on the purchase price of new housing removed. That's one of the biggest things the federal government could do. The other thing I think they should be looking at is the Australia model for the foreign buyer restriction. Australia implemented a model that actually exempted new construction because they recognized the importance of pre-sales to that market. And, you know, pre-sales are basically a form of capital to move new housing ahead. And so Australia looked at it and said, okay, well, you know, we want this immigration. We want these people moving here. They'll invest. They want to invest in real estate. We can target that investment into building new housing. That creates net new housing for residents as well and natural born citizens of the country. And then you can tax the use at the end. So focus on taxing vacancy if somebody wants to leave it vacant, but let's get the homes built. Let's not have a situation where we're not building any homes because we can't pre-sell some of the homes. That's the Australia model. And then I think the mortgage stress test needs a complete revisit. It was put in place when interest rates were effectively zero. And, you know, through the financial crisis in 08, we had an incredibly stable banking system here. And it's been held up globally as an example of that. And so this stress test is really punishing people getting into the market for the first time, or I think in more cases actually is punishing people moving out of their first place into their second place because they're having kids, which we really should want people to do as a country. And it's all of these things together is really suppressing demand for housing at a time that there isn't any. And so we need to stimulate some housing demand because we put a lot of these levers on to control demand when the market was really hot. So that's what I think the federal government can do short term. Provincially, you know, I think this is back to housing taxation. Property transfer tax is a major part of the provincial budget. It's a major line item of revenue, and it's a tax on our residents for trying to kind of move to manage their lives. It's a tax you pay for having a kid and needing to move to a bigger home. It's a tax that you pay if you're downsizing and freeing up a single family home for a family. So I think in a time where, you know, one of the largest economic sectors in the province is struggling and isn't producing and is doing layoffs, all of these taxes need to be revisited. We have provincial bans on foreign purchasers as well that I think are due for a revisit, noting that the NDP themselves and David Eby came out and said, these are the most popular policies that we have. Well, if they're preventing housing getting built, is that really the right thing? And is it time to look at the Australia model that we mentioned? And then I think a major thing the province could do is stop changing the building code every couple of years. We need the cost increases baked into code to just stop. And we need to let the construction industry kind of settle on a standard for a little bit. And then finally, this is a bit of a long list. There actually is a ton of savings to both developers and consumers if we move development charges from being paid upfront to actually being paid by the consumer when they complete on a sale, because it bakes in a lot of tax on tax when it's included in the price. So you're paying GST on that cost, you're paying property transfer on that cost. And so there's actually quite a bit of savings to the end consumer by actually paying that directly like they do PTT rather than the developer baking it in and paying it up front, taking debt out to cover it, taking a profit margin on that cost. And Mike Moffitt and his team at the Missing Middle Initiative have done some great work on the savings to consumers on that. So that's a major initiative the provincial government could take.
That's a great suggestion, that the last one there. We obviously, in the brokerage side of things, see the slowdown in the development land sales, and various conversations have happened. But I think maybe levying some of those costs on the end consumer versus, like you said, baking them in might eventually get things going. And obviously, these are a lot of upfront costs that you guys have to consider paying in advance.
Well, and it also doesn't cost anyone anything. All it does is move the payment dates to the government. And you know, government debt is a lot cheaper than mortgage debt. And so it's starting to look at these systematic issues and trying to line up, you know, all of these things. And I think it's gotten so acute because in 2019, the Metro Vancouver DCC was $1,082 per unit. And now it's scheduled to be, I think, 22,000. And so that type of growth creates a significant cost pressure. And then on top of that, the municipal rates are increasing as well. And so what used to be a conversation about an $1,100 fee is now a conversation about $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 in development charges. So the scale of it has just changed so much.
Unreal. Well, you guys have obviously been in this business for a long time there at West Group. You guys have probably seen multiple cycles and stuff like that. What's your take with regards to the market? And I'll sort of provide a little bit of stuff from just like what we've seen on the brokerage side of things. Q4 for us as a company was extremely busy. Now, I'm not saying prices are going up, I'm saying transactions are happening. January also feels like it's kind of trended in that way. What are your predictions for 2026, at least on the development side, considering you guys have been around for decades?
It's a really weird market right now. So West Group's actually in its 70th year of home building this year. And, you know, speaking with our chairman, the owner of the company, you know, he said a little while ago, it's rare that everything's bad all at once. You know, we have an economy that's struggling. Immigration's been shut off. Cost pressures haven't really eased up. And the market's way down. Usually it's, you know, one or two of those things at a time. It's not all of the things all at the same time. And so I think, you know, overall macro level sentiment, I think nationally, there's a little bit more optimism. Provincially, you know, I don't talk to a lot of people in any industry that have a ton of confidence in the direction of our province right now. The amount of debt that we're carrying, the new budget that's coming out next week. I think Brenda Bailey, the finance minister, has already put out there that she thinks she's going to be the most unpopular person in the province for a long time. So I think, you know, that puts a cloud over sort of everyone's ongoing employment, their confidence in the market, their confidence in taking risk. This is a very cyclical business and you're investing in the long term. Real estate is a long-term investment. You know, we fundamentally believe in this region and believe in cities. But I think 2026 is going to be a pretty tough year. We have a massive amount of unsold inventory that's still under construction or sitting on the sidelines. And so, you know, builders need to churn through that. I don't know that we'll see any projects launch at any kind of scale. I don't think we'll see a large project launch this year. We'll continue to see rental being built that was already planned or in the ground. We're going to see the number of rental starts slow down as rents fall. It's just hard to make those numbers pencil anymore. And you can't really hit institutional investment criteria. That investment's still happening. It's just happening in countries where they can make a return that's commensurate for the extreme risk. So I think we're going to see a pretty marked slowdown in activity this year. A lot of what's keeping everybody busy is redoing a lot of the work they've been doing. And that's a lot of what our teams are doing, is you're right-sizing projects, you're renegotiating things with cities, you're, as they're changing policies, you're reworking things to try to find windows. But it's requiring, you know, it's going to be a really creative year for people to try to, you know, basically work themselves out of sites. But I think it's going to be a challenging year for sales. That said, I think, you know, the fundamentals are still there of this region. It's an attractive place to live. It's a place that attracts immigration. And I think if we can see some of these, you know, air quotes, nation building projects proceed, our region's well suited to benefit from that. It's just a matter of that kind of happening or not.
Yeah. I guess as a final question, is there any particular markets that you guys are excited about in 2026?
Oh, I'm trying to find some optimism here. I mean, I think we're looking at things we're looking at de-risking right now. I think what we continue to be excited about is long-term. We continue to see a desire for people to live in highly amenitized communities. We see that in our master plans, that in a lot of cases, you know, you can continue to outperform the market. It's hard to look at the whole market and broad brush it because it's so varied submarket by submarket. You know, we've had some really strong rental lease up programs this last year and into this year that have outperformed the market. But I think, you know, an overall level of caution, I think the interest in this region continues to be high. It's just that the overall economy and the what we call the cost of delivery crisis is preventing a lot of things from going ahead.
Well, Brad, you know how the program works. We get to ask you 6 lighthearted questions before we let you go here back to the desk there. Do you have just a few more minutes for us?
Of course.
All right, Brad, 2026, we just got into it. We're recording this first week of February, but do you have any 2026 resolutions or goals that you're looking to fulfill this year?
Try to be more positive. That's probably the only one.
I think you and everybody else in the industry is trying to take a more positive outlook on 2025. A book recommendation for our listeners, and doesn't have to be real estate related, but it can.
So I'm reading it right now. It's not real estate related. It's an old Western called Lonesome Dove that I'm actually really enjoying. And I don't often read fictions or novel. I read a lot of, you know, autobiographies and political biographies and things like that. So it's been a nice brain break for me.
Good to hear. If you find the time in 2026, where are you vacationing?
Okay, I have a really weird trip coming up. My 7-year-old daughter somehow is a fan of the quite old country singer Tanya Tucker.
Okay.
And she wanted to go to a concert. So her and I are actually going to the Mississippi State Rodeo in a couple weeks to go to the rodeo and a couple country concerts.
You know, I personally like country music. I can't say I'm a fan of Tanya Tucker, but good honor. And I'm sure it'll be a great time. I'm sure nothing beats a good country concert, in my opinion. Yeah. In my opinion. Over under. Do Canucks finish last place this year?
I think they'll find a way to not finish last place, which might be the worst outcome.
Knowing our luck when it comes to the draft and our hockey making decisions, we're going to probably go 10-0 to end the season and screw ourselves in the draft and pick 9th or something to that effect. We just can't figure it out.
I can see that happen.
All right, Brad, last question up here. I know as a shareholder of the Packers, you guys aren't in the Super Bowl, but do you have a prediction for our Super Bowl champ this year?
Pretty partial to the Seahawks. I think defense is phenomenal. So we'll see. And I think Sam Darnold's been looking pretty good.
Yeah, I think he's a tough guy. Again, I'm going to say this from an outsider's perspective, but I'm not the biggest NFL fan, enough that I know the players. I watch it, but I'm not into all the stats. For him to go 14 wins last year with the Vikings, almost get put out to dry, gets another 13 or 14 wins this year with the Seahawks, ends up in the Super Bowl. Like, I'm rooting for that guy as the underdog to kind of prove everybody wrong. So
I also heard his grandfather was the original Marlboro man, which I think is pretty cool.
I did not know that. Okay. More reason to cheer from Brad. How can all of our listeners find out more about all the amazing projects and stuff you guys are doing over at West Group?
Yeah, look, you know, you can look up West Group, westgroup.ca. And then, you know, if you're in for some nerdy stats analysis on the industry, feel free to follow me on LinkedIn too.
Amazing. Well, Brad, I thank you for taking the time out of your busy day to do this again and sort of shedding a little bit of light on the backside of the development world and explaining why developers can't just build at the pace everyone expects them to. Thank you once again for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad. Take care. There we have it, folks. Our interview today with Brad Jones of West Group. Love having Brad on the program. And I think one thing too that kind of, I think he had some great suggestions here, and we talked about what can make this market move faster. And pushing on the cost of CACs and DCCs as a closing cost for condos when purchased, I think is a really smart idea. What the public may not understand is these are costs that have to, or municipal costs that have to get paid to cities and communities during the project's development. And the developer has to add these costs into their performas. So when we as the public are paying $800 a foot or $900 a foot for a condo, a portion of that condo per foot price is going towards these costs they had to pay up front. So moving those costs onto your statement of adjustment at closing, just like property transfer tax, would A, you'd pay less per foot for it, but B, would also make the financing of the project on the developer side a lot easier to pallet and could potentially help get some more shovels into the ground faster as we go in cycles in the housing market. Right now, we're in probably a down cycle where we have a little bit more inventory than we typically see. It's maybe a little bit more of a buyer's market. Multifamily owners and people who have residential investment properties might have a higher vacancy than they normally see. That will all correct itself at some point when we have back to normal levels of immigration, foreign buyers come back, international students come back. That will then get us back into the housing crunch that we're traditionally dealing with. And that's going to put further pressure when that time comes for all the developments that aren't getting built today that will be delivered in 12, 24, and 36 months down the road. So I think Brad had some tremendous suggestions there. Highly recommend to follow him on LinkedIn. He's always great for posting there. And then also follow him at West Group. Thanks once again for joining, guys. We'll be back next week with another great episode. Take care.
Subscribe today.